welcome to the season two opener of Sit Still, Look Opinionated, the podcast. Bow, bow, bow. As you remember, I'm your host, Claire Malky. We are so excited to be back. Mike and I are pumped to share with you all the episodes we have in store. But before we kick off season two, how did your political conversations go? What was that experience like? Did you learn something about your friends or family, or even about yourself? These conversations are a straight path to empathy, and we will keep encouraging all of you dear listeners to keep them up. Just a heads up, we're changing our format for this season. Hope you like it. Whatever, no regrets. We've got a great show in store for you all today. We'll be exploring political ideologies and their effects, and we have a great interview with Dr. Jan Jacobs. And since we're so excited to be back, this episode is a little longer than normal. We know you missed us. It's been a hot summer here in Chicago. And you know what can aid that? You already know it, a refreshing margarita. Grab your drink and let's get started. Up first, this week's headlines. For the first time in decades, a Kennedy has lost a primary election. If you ask me, I say he dodged a bullet. According to the New York Times, reports of $62 million of fraud appeared in the PPP program, which is apparently related to the coronavirus aid, and not the DMs that Insta models received from their fans. This week, the Wall Street Journal reported that many metropolitan cities can't keep up with the amount of trash their residents create. Although this may be a smelly situation for neighbors, it reeks of city budget cuts. Trump's new COVID-19 advisor, Scott Atlas, is championing the herd immunity approach in response to stopping the coronavirus. Based on movies I've watched, this is exactly how you start a zombie apocalypse. It makes me wonder, Atlas must really trust this virus to work according to his plan. He reminds me of a young parent in one of those toddler, self-control, don't eat the Oreo TikToks. Atlas is like, okay, COVID, I'm gonna go on vacation for a few weeks, and when I get back, all these people better still be alive. And then COVID is like, nah, F you, Dad, I'm gonna be more deadly than ever. And by the way, the toddler always eats the Oreos, which is exactly what the virus is doing to humanity, eating us all one by one until we return as zombies. The New York Times reported that Trump supporters were in strife over recent polls, although that seems generous, as I don't believe many of them know what strife means. Recent reports state that Russia is once again spreading disinformation on Facebook and Twitter. But I'm not convinced. It could be anybody. It could be some 400-pound guy with small hands on his cell phone in DC. Who knows? This week, the Biden-Harris campaign introduced yard signs on Animal Crossing. Now, I haven't personally played Animal Crossing yet, mostly because I would become an actual couch potato. This podcast would cease to exist. In response to this campaign ploy, Trump has cried voter fraud out of fear that Biden is trying to solicit votes from NPCs. On Wednesday, Trump encouraged his supporters in North Carolina to commit voter fraud. There would normally be a joke here, but on Wednesday, Trump encouraged his supporters in North Carolina to commit voter fraud. Nancy Pelosi was seen going to a salon not wearing a mask despite a ban on the services in California. While upsetting, Republicans are still angrier about this than what happened on Wednesday when Trump encouraged his supporters in North Carolina to commit voter fraud. Seriously though, for real? A salon? I swear, Democrats are the New York Giants of politics because they always know how to screw up a lead. They are experts at shooting themselves in the foot. Should we adapt the policies that our base is getting excited about? Nah, let's just stick to the strategy that we lost with the last time. In hindsight, though, this is still not as concerning compared to what happened on Wednesday, when Trump encouraged his supporters in North Carolina to commit voter fraud. And that's this week's headlines. Now time for this week's deep dive. Okay, let's jump in. Today, we're going to be talking about all of those isms. You know what I mean. Capitalism, communism, fascism, and socialism. All of these terms that we use to categorize things in politics. Because just like high school, everything always has to have a label. America is like a teenager screaming, "Oh my God, Mom, I am not socialist. Me and socialism are just talking. Ugh." But essentially, America is a nation of identity. Actually, I would say America is a nation of overconsumption, and so by association, we are a nation of overconsumption of identity. What I mean by that is that people are quick to latch onto one idea and either wholly promote or demonize a stance based on the ideology of that one idea, even though anything rarely is black and white and instead often multifaceted. For example, America is a nation that is built on capitalism, and that's what it's all about, hokey pokey style. And any attempt to add socialized programs is a direct path to socialism or communism, which, according to my uncle at Thanksgiving, is bad. But what exactly is capitalism, or socialism, or communism, or even fascism? I'm sure I learned about some of this stuff back in fifth grade, but to be honest, I would have a hard time explaining what each one is. I vaguely remember socialism and communism being Russia and China, fascism is Hitler, and capitalism is what gave me my Venture One card, right? Well, we all know none of what I just said would be enough to beat a Jeff Foxworthy game show, let alone pass the fifth grade. So let's take the time to really break down what they are. Before we jump in, I want to preface this bit with a quote from the University of Idaho's website. "There are some inherent pitfalls in trying to offer simple, bite-sized definitions of capitalism, socialism, communism, and fascism. The first being that these are complex concepts concerning both economics and government, so short definitions will be incomplete. The second being that these concepts are not always mutually exclusive. Most modern states combine elements of more than one. The third being that historical states define these terms differently. And finally, some of the terms refer strictly to economic systems, capitalism, while others also refer to government and economic systems, communism and fascism." With that being said, let's start with capitalism. Like I said before, I grew up hearing that America was a nation built on capitalism. You know the phrase, America, the land of the free, home of the capitalists. I joke. But I also tend to find that a lot of people both define America as free and capitalist. So by definition, being capitalist is the same as being free. Is that true? Well, defined, capitalism is an economic system in which all or most of the means of production are privately owned and operated. And the investment of capital and the production, distribution, and prices of commodities, goods and services, are determined mainly in a free market, rather than by the state. In other words, in capitalism, the means of production are generally operated for profit. And yes, you're right. You did hear the word free in that definition, a free market. So I guess that's true. But in an economic system, what is the opposite of free? Well, don't worry, you don't have to reach for your dictionaries because I already have that one for you. The answer is not free. Actually, I guess in a capitalist market, it would be priced. And outside of a capitalist market, it would be the liberal agenda. That sounds right. I mean, we basically just nailed capitalism right here in the paragraph. Podcast over, mic drop. To simplify, here are some pros and cons of capitalism. Pros include, consumers are free to choose which products and services they buy and use. This creates supply and demand and can therefore drive innovation fueled by the desire to be wealthy. Options, baby. The incentive to make a lot of money leads to more efficiency. And I guess that's it. More options, more money. But those are still two pretty good options. On the flip side, the cons include booms and busts in economic cycles. the ability to form monopolies to exploit consumers, more exposure to damaging the environment, and a trend to inequality and burnout among workers. Like, huge inequality. Shout out to everyone else rocking three jobs to pay rent. Just kidding, COVID happened. There are no more jobs right now. Thanks, Obama. Of course. What I was leading up to is that usually if you propose an idea that is any degree short of capitalism, there's usually someone jumping through your living room wall, Kool-Aid style, screaming, COMMUNISM! As if communism works under the same set of rules as Beetlejuice, and the only way to send it back to its grave is to shout it multiple times in a row. However, before we address communism, it seems more appropriate to address socialism first. I feel like a lot of people confuse socialism and communism as the same thing. I know I did. But as it turns out, they're actually different forms of thinking. Similar, but different. Let me explain. See, where capitalism refers to private ownership of property and production, socialism refers to state ownership of property or production. A purely socialist society would be one in which the state owns and operates the means of production, i.e., the government runs everything. Examples of socialism are things like public universities, federal and state highways, federal and state parks, harbors, social security, etc. You may be thinking, wait, but we have those things in America. I thought America was a capitalist nation. That's correct. We have both. In fact, nearly all modern capitalist countries combine socialism and capitalism. Bah, bah, bah. I know, crazy, right? But anyway, socialism does have a lot of great pros. Probably most important that common goals are more important than selfish desires. This leads to things like reduction in poverty, regulation on unfair business practices like monopolies, universal healthcare, and protection of the environment. You're probably thinking, wait, but my religion tells me to put others ahead of myself, and I try to do that daily. That's great, but that's not what systematically happens in capitalism. In socialism, big companies and corporations work together to create a healthy environment, both for the workers and the world around us, not just the bottom line. Cons, on the other hand, include a possible lack of incentives to create innovations, high taxes to run government programs, and governments run a risk of failing if not every piece works in perfect balance. And lastly, a large welfare program could render people jobless without any incentive to find work again. That is, if money is the only thing that drives an incentive. So, with that in mind, how is socialism different or similar to communism? Communism refers to community ownership of property, with the end goal being complete social equality via economic equality. The idea of communism is to empower the worker and to eliminate the idea of status so that everyone is equal. Along the same lines of equality, a key element in communism is that there is no such thing as private property or ownership. Technically, the community controls and operates all facets of economic productions, and therefore provides all citizens with what they need to get by, i.e. food, shelter, education, and healthcare. And each person in the community receives a portion based on their needs. One more thing about communism. In order to achieve the empowered worker and statusless environment, a violent revolution to overthrow the middle and upper class will inevitably occur. In other words, while both parties value the community as a whole versus the individual, socialism is still grounded in a democratic process, whereas communism wants what's best for the people, but doesn't trust the people to know what's best for them. And so all decisions are made by the government. This inherently leads to an authoritative state. Kind of like my way or the highway, except it's my way or secret unmarked members of the military will come to your house in the middle of the night and abduct you, and then will erase you from the system, and you will never be heard from again. From my point of view, this is a major split from socialism. Lastly, I want to address an oldie that's starting to make a comeback, and that's fascism. Hitler's bread and butter. I feel like everyone is familiar with fascism, but like the other isms, not really familiar with fascism. Not that you want to be too familiar with fascism. Me personally, I am quite content with me and fascism being perfect strangers. As the University of Idaho again describes, fascism is a government system led by a dictator having complete power, forcibly suppressing opposition and criticism, regimenting all industry, commerce, etc., and emphasizing aggressive nationalism and often racism. Which, I mean, like, You know who this describes. You know the line I want to draw right now. I'm going to try not to because it's the lowest hanging fruit, but I mean, just come on. If someone hands you bubble wrap, you're not going to pop it. It's just too obvious. Ugh, forget it. I'm just going to move on. It's Trump. Trump is who I was referring to. I like to imagine that if he came face to face with someone saying that, he would chase them. But there's no way he's catching this segue into pros and cons. By the way, I Googled it and someone actually put together a pros and cons list for fascism. One of the pros is it speeds up the decision-making process. I can't even. Honestly, the only pros are for the dictator. In that case, I guess the cons sort of depend on the personality of the dictator. Like, who knows? Maybe fascism could be really cool if Tom Hanks was our supreme leader. We may never know. But he did get COVID, so not sure about that one. Of course, the types of personality traits associated with fascist dictators don't tend to be Tom Hanks cool. So usually cons lean more on the side of things like oppression of freedom of speech, violence towards groups based on prejudice or racism, massive economic inequality, disregard for law and order. In fact, we posted a link to signs of fascism on our Instagram over the summer. We'll include a link in the show notes, but just to give you an idea of what to look for, here are a couple. Early warning signs of fascism. Powerful and continuing nationalism. Disdain for human rights. Identification of enemies as a unifying cause. Supremacy of the military. Rampant sexism. Controlled mass media. Obsession with national security. Religion and government intertwined. Corporate power protected. Labor power suppressed. Disdain for intellectuals and the arts. Obsession with crime and punishment. Rampant criticism and corruption, and fraudulent elections. Something I do find fairly interesting is that while I myself was quick to label Trump as a fascist, I have been quite surprised to hear Republicans call Democrats fascist with an equal level of moral smugness. Kind of made me think, you know? Are they so blind to their own projection? Or am I so blind to my hatred of this symbol of the Republican Party that it may, in fact, have blinded me to aspects of the party that I have decided to unify behind? It's probably gas, just moving on. So, now you understand these isms and their intricacies. But where did all these political ideologies come from? Like, they didn't just fall out of the sky, right? No, they were of course created by us humans. And to understand these concepts, we've got to go a little further back in history than we have on previous episodes. In this history lesson, I want you to put everything in the lens of response. These political ideologies are sort of like a weird, dysfunctional family tree. Their roots are interconnected, and they emerged as reactions to the former systems that were in power. To understand how the domino effect happened, we first need to visit the Middle Ages in Europe. The main system of power during this era was feudalism. The grandfather for going with this family tree thing. As a refresher, feudalism is the hierarchical political organization system where wealthy lords owned all of the land in the town and offered housing and protection to all the townspeople. In return, the peasants farmed all the land for the wealthy lord. Pretty familiar scene, right? Like, just imagine almost any classic Disney movie and you'll get it. This system presided in Europe from about the 9th century through the 15th century, until it collapsed thanks to the bubonic plague. A disease that quickly spread throughout the continent and killed nearly 60% of Europe's population. I wonder what work from home looked like back then. Well, farming. It probably looked like farming. With this collapse, rural farmers and craftsmen gradually started moving into urbanized cities in search for a way to survive. The more populated areas offered jobs in factories and warehouses. Which brings us to the Industrial Revolution. Which emerged during the latter half of the 18th century and saw the development of mass production through machines and factories. Those handcrafted goods could now be churned out in record numbers, and the competition erupted. Side note here, I initially learned about all this stuff in like the 7th grade, and from my available memories, the Industrial Revolution was taught to be this beacon of hope and what brought us into modern times. It was like, yay, history made it out of the Dark Ages, good job! But was it really any better than before? Let's jump forward and compare. Enter the emergence of capitalism, aka the eldest son who takes over the family business and does a little company rebranding, but it's really all the same product. The feudal lords are replaced by factory owners and workhouse foremen, and the rural farmers become cogs in the wheel as the working class. In fact, Once educated, the farmers elevated themselves to be public servants in the eyes of the law, and by definition became rural jurors. If you know, you know. Industrialization not only caused major divides in the economic world, but also in the social hierarchy of society. As the rich got richer, the poor got poorer. It became harder and harder for the working-class urbanites to rise above their station. The Industrial Revolution swept across Europe despite the class divide. Then enter Henri Saint-Simon, Robert Owen, and Charles Fourier. These 19th-century philosophers presented their own ideology that proposed an alternative to the capitalism and the inherent competition it creates. And hence, the idea of socialism was born. If we look at our family tree analogy, this is the cool aunt who just wants everyone to get along. Who cares if the turkey is dry? At least the family made the meal together. Everyone benefits from a cooperative system. She might be a little baked come dinner time if you catch my drift. But for some, the idea of cooperation didn't go far enough. In 1848, German political philosopher Karl Marx published the Communist Manifesto. In this publication, Marx criticized socialist thinkers and called their system utopian and unrealistic. I guess mirrors hadn't been invented by then or something. Marx's main argument in the Communist Manifesto was that all of human history consisted of class warfare, and then eventually the working class, or the proletariat, would rise up from under the capitalist class, the bourgeois, and take control of production and forever erase classes. Although Marx was critical of socialism, he did report that socialism is a gateway into creating a communist society. This is part of the reason why there's so much confusion around the definitions of socialism and communism. In the family tree, this is that cool aunt's son, aka the cousin who's disillusioned with their mom's let's just all work together talk. It's not about working together, it's about everyone pulling their weight. Which brings us to that estranged family member that everyone's sort of agreed to stop inviting to family gatherings. This uncle that takes the family football game way too seriously and bullies everyone else into playing it his way, even if it means breaking all the rules. Yep, you guessed it. This is fascism. As we discussed earlier, fascism is when a dictator has complete control over the government and economy. Benito Mussolini first introduced this ideology in Italy during the 1920s. Mussolini broke away from Italian socialists and created the Fasci di Combattimento, a right-wing organization that propped up Italian nationalism and terrorized its leftist opponents. By 1922, the Italian parliament struggled to properly govern. Italian King Emmanuel III was basically powerless, and asked Mussolini to create a new governing system. Mussolini was pronounced the prime minister and worked with the parliament for a little while until 1925, when the fascist state was officially instituted, with Mussolini as Il Duce, aka the leader. Now, obviously, fascism didn't only exist in Italy. It prevailed in Germany with the rise of Hitler and made an appearance in Spain during Franco's Spanish Civil War, as well as a slew of other countries throughout Europe and Asia. Eventually, these fascist regimes fell, but their influence is still prevalent in many parts of the world. So we arrive at our age-old question, why does all this matter? Well, it's important to understand these political ideologies so you can understand their effects on you as a citizen. What is life like as a capitalist versus a socialist versus a communist? Life as a private citizen looks very different in these societies. By understanding the nuances of each ideology, you can see the shifts in the world around you, and you'll be equipped to stand your ground when that incessant Facebook friend comments "communist" on every post about wearing a mask. Remember, this is a starting point, and we always encourage you to do your own research. That's what we did, after all. Now, to be honest here, I don't know what exactly we as individuals can do to stop the rise of fascism. That's not entirely true. We have the power to vote. Please, please vote. But more importantly, we have the power to question everything. I refuse to accept the idea that this is just the way it is, and neither should you. In this season of the podcast, we're going to dig a little more into these why questions and discover ways we all can synthesize the world around us. Stay tuned with my interview with Doctor of Political Science, Dr. Jan Jacobs. By the way, we're still in a pandemic and can't bring anyone into the studio for health reasons. So our audio for the interviews is still hashtag work from home, but the content is really great, so make sure you listen. So for today's episode, we have Dr. Jan Jacobs. And we are super excited to have her on the show today. Welcome, Dr. Jacobs.
Well, thank you, Bear. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm very excited.
Yes, we are so excited to have you on the show as well. So to get us started, could you give us a little bit about your background and how you got into academia?
It probably started, I'm a child of the 60s. Generally speaking, I grew up during a kind of activist period, but it was also a lot to do with learning new ideas and concepts. It was not a straight line from high school to college, but there was a lot of experiences in between. I was in my 30s when I decided I wanted a PhD, which meant I had to get a master's, et cetera. I was just in a good position to do that. And, it's the work on the advanced degree that gave me skills of research and communicating in the written word, although academic writing is very different than any other kind of writing because we pretend we're objective kind of thing. But, it took me from the time I was 18 to the time I was 49 to complete the academic part. And then I came into, I taught college a little bit. And then, as you know, I came into high school teaching shortly after receiving my degree. And then I retired a couple of years ago. And, I've been gainfully enjoying my life.
Amazing. So you mentioned you're a child of the 60s. That time is being compared a lot to right now. What are your thoughts on that, having lived through it all?
You know, it's been interesting because all these high-profile civil rights leaders, African-American civil rights leaders of the 60s, have been passing. And really, literally, to quote Kennedy, the torch has been passed to a new generation. And I'm very excited about it. I always feel confident when people stand up and participate in democracy, because that's what this 60s was really about, participating, because democracy, at least the kind of democracies we hope for, don't exist without citizen participation. And the basic action every citizen needs to take is voting. And then if you want to get further involved, there are avenues for doing that. And that's really what I've learned in the 60s. And when I went back to finish my BA, I ended up in Madison, Wisconsin. So I went to the UW, and that experience, I became like head of the student government there, and I learned how to work within a bureaucracy. A lot of people capture student leadership positions and think they're going to, well, it's like any politician. You think you're going to really change things rather than kind of working through the system, which is, I know it can be such a drag. But things take time. As a historian, I know that change unfolds over time. I mean, right now we're dealing with something that was embedded in this nation's history 400 years ago, if not longer, because of our descent from Great Britain. You know, the slave trade was pretty universal. You know, it's time for a reckoning. It's time for a little truth and reconciliation. It doesn't help that we've got, you know, who blocking all that and threatening and being fearful that he's going to lose his power. Short answer is I am so gratified that the next generation, I guess the kids that could be my grandchildren, are picking up their flag and walking forward. It's a relief.
Yeah.
It's a real relief. It means it's still happening. You know, and that people still care.
Yeah, and that's the whole point of this show, is carrying that torch and giving people the tools they need to carry the flame and, you know, make change happen. So on this episode, we're discussing political ideologies. And honestly, I have heard a lot in my life people throw around like, oh, that's communism, like that's anti-American, like that's socialism, that's bad, like capitalism's great. And I don't know necessarily what my opinions are on which one is the best or things like that. And I think I've had to unlearn a little bit of, you know, these ideologies that are ingrained in our society. Can you talk a little bit about how capitalism and maybe socialism and communism, why sometimes they work against each other, or why people put them in these boxes that are so far away?
Right. Well, first, let's just start out that what we're really dealing with is political theory. Everything mm-hmm. starts with an idea. And what makes America so wedded to capitalism is that Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith was published in 1776. And since this country was kind of a brand new thing, our economy, just by the way the transformation was occurring, kind of fell towards the capitalist model. In any ism, there's a political level, there's an economic and a social level. Mm-hmm. So democratic capitalism basically speaks to individual rights. Our Constitution is based on 18th century thought. Mm-hmm. And if you study it from that context, you get a lot more understanding of what this is about. But at any rate, when you meld money, economy with idea, and you say, you know, we're all about individuality, free market, open space, you know, free market economy presupposes a free market of ideas, free speech, everything goes. And what you get is the worst. You get this greedy, kind of toxic amalgamation of people doing things to get ahead and create as much wealth off of something else or someone else. Mm-hmm. You know, we're in Machiavelli territory now, ends justifying means. But capitalism, when it's divorced from a moral ethical code, when it's divorced from its humanitarian side, well, you can see what it is. I think everybody in America can see what it is right now. Where socialism, which really falls between capitalism and communism, is basically individuals can own and do private property things, but the state basically owns the prime generator of wealth, be that the industries, whatever it might be, and manages that. And but it's still taking care of its population. It guarantees them that their basic needs will be taken care of, but they can pursue as an individual, you know, other avenues. They're not imposing. And, you know, the downside to that is state-run businesses can be cumbersome. You know, it takes forever for things to happen. You want that energy of entrepreneurship that capitalism offers somehow blended in. Well, look at countries like Sweden mm-hmm. or Iceland or Finland. One of the things that makes it work is it's a homogeneous population. I really believe that. They're small enough units that can be managed in a way that a continental country cannot. But again, looking at a organization of political, social, and economic, one of the great things about socialism is even though the state owns like the major means of production, it's run by democratically elected officials. Mm-hmm. So there's a mechanism in place for the people to be heard. And there's a lot of openness, a lot of discussion. It's what people, you know, point to Bernie Sanders, a social democrat. And you know what? Social democracy is appealing. Mm-hmm. Social democracy is very appealing when it's managed properly. Large scale social democracy, I don't know. I lived on a kibbutz years ago, and kibbutz in Israel is...
Oh, yes, I actually don't know where that is.
Okay, mm-hmm. A kibbutz means collective, a community. Mm-hmm. And in Israel, when the state, prior to the state being established, mm-hmm. The Jewish population coming in established these collective farms. And the idea, there was a social democratic idea behind it. They all were going to be farmers. That's the Eastern European thing. Mm-hmm. But they would share in the functions of the communal living. So, for instance, when I lived on a kibbutz, the head, the administrative head, He was there for 3 years and rotated out. Everybody rotated in and out of functions. Nobody was running any one thing for years and years and years. It has a quality of, you know, of their talents to each according to their needs. Mm-hmm. And one of the things in a communal a social democracy like that is they pull their resources. And everybody gets a turn to go, you know, on a long abroad, going abroad on a vacation, but you might not get to do it every year. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have 1,500 people on a kibbutz or families, if you have like 700 families, it's going to be a rotation. But they it works. But I'm talking about 1,500 people.
Mm-hmm. A smaller community.
In my
research that I've been doing for this episode, I was learning about New Harmony, Indiana, which was like a city in Indiana that it was communal, and they tried to be like separate in their own, and it worked for a while, but I didn't really catch why it dissolved.
They fall apart for various reasons, and I think things like that actually fall apart because an individual rises that wants to be a little more dictatorial than, you know, it wants to stay where they are. It always kind of seems to descend into something like the Shakers. You know, the Shakers have this wonderful community, but it petered out because nobody was interested in the kind of rules of that society. And the same with New Harmony. I mean, in the 19th century, there were a lot of utopian societies. I mean, the Mormonism comes out of that. Mm-hmm. As well, that's still around, but small units are what's necessary, I think, for it to really work. And cooperation, you know, really having people cooperate with what's necessary at the moment. You're going to have dissenters, but you don't want most people get on board, particularly if they're being taken care of. Communism is really a total system where the state owns every means of production. There can be 100% employment because the state will employ you, but the state supposedly needs to supply housing, you know, the basics, housing, food, employment, and in exchange for that, they have the right to control all the industries in the country. That's where I think totalitarianism comes from. I mean, Nazism is like the right-wing version of communism. National socialism is really, you know, what it was termed. They were two, you know, different interpretations of how it was going to be. And the difference, really, in Germany at that time was the government opened itself to private enterprise, where communism wasn't looking at that. Mm-hmm. And still doesn't look at that. China is an odd hybrid right now.
Yeah.
Because they did open up to capitalism, to a market economy. But at the base, I mean, the capitalistic countries are screaming, this isn't fair because you shore up your businesses. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's like it's a game. You have to play by these rules if you're going to be a capitalist. But I, you know, what did I used to say in class? I told everybody that we lived in a democracy. You could go to Best Buy. You could go to Target. You could go to any store of your choice. You could go in any industry of your choice. But after that, you know, the people who run it, no one wants to let go of like your authority once they get it. And all these isms are about how do you manage the relationship between people and authority. Mm-hmm. And the American Republic, as it was conceived, or the Democratic Republic of America, is a pretty good theory. Mm-hmm. You know, we have virtual representation, but as we well know, not everybody we elect reflects our own view, but that's one of the prices we pay for the balance of power in our country. And it's still significant where I live that the legislative branch is the first article of the Constitution, not the executive. Mm-hmm. So particularly because in 18th century, 1, 2, 3, 4 meant something, the ascending order meant something. And they're putting the executive kind of in the middle. where it should be to one way or the other, but they're all meant to balance each other, which is very unique. We're not like any other democracy on the planet. The other thing that's a little difficult in America with the left and the center and the right accuses the left of essentially being totalitarian, while the left, and I'm talking about America, accuses the right of the same thing. There is a good argument that if the left, and I mean the left, got in control of the machine, they would be no different than the right who got control of the machine. The you know, Buddha's right, the middle way. You want a moderate approach and management of society, because mostly people just want a roof over their head, food in their stomach, education for their children, and to have a nice life. They're not looking, you know, and all these systems, all of them, come out to a level of power, and it's about power grabbing and maintaining it. But we can change that, but we have to work very hard at that. And I think that's coming back to the movement that's occurring now. That is what's going on now. Okay. And if we can actually balance this out, if we can actually take some of the teeth out of racism, we can actually start seeing one another as human beings without a category attached based on some kind of delirious notion. And that I always think is the end goal. I've always thought of race is racism, and I think we know what that is about. And it's embedded in our Constitution. I mean, they never use the word slavery in the preamble and in, but they imply it everywhere. And that was to appease the South, or that system in the South, that agricultural system. And it's still with us because it's like a tree. And at its root, it's a lot of nourishing things, but there's a virus in there. And, you know, meta level, coronavirus is a pretty good analogy of how this works. Kind of thing. But isms, you know, people want things to be absolute. And isms are actually based on absolutism, you know, rather than a single person. Although in something like fascism or communism, we like to think of a cult of personality. So you have one leader at the center, and he is the icon of the party. And he's the supreme leader. And what he says goes. And he has people working with him. You know, like in Russia, it was the Politburo. You know, there was Stalin or Khrushchev, whoever at the center. And then you just have this group of bureaucrats at the top that then carry out what they agree upon. But the buck stops with somebody like Stalin or Hitler. Kind of. So the world today is really leaning more towards a dictatorial bent. And like, I'm going to tell you what to do at all times. So it's scary.
Yeah. It's definitely been a moment that I've never felt change happening. Like I've never, and I don't know if this is for good or for bad, even though those are such, you know, broad terms, but just seeing what's happening in Portland and, you know, what may be coming soon to Chicago is, it's something that I feel like growing up, I was like, oh, that would never happen in America. And especially, unfortunately, me being a white woman who had an affluent upbringing, to see all of this happening and to see people I personally know out in this, you know, at the square downtown in Chicago, it's definitely a moment to take note of.
Are they at Federal Plaza?
No one is here yet, but it's definitely like there's protesters always.
Well, the echo is that Chicago was ground zero for the Democratic National Convention in 1968.
Oh.
the bottom line is that in 1968, the Democrats held a convention in Chicago, and the SDS, the Yippies, the countercultural element, all came, and the anti-war movement, all came to Chicago in August, the end of August of 1968, because they wanted to see the war end. They didn't like Hubert Humphrey very much, but the whole counterculture kind of coalesced. And there was, while they were nominating, doing all that stuff inside, the police, and there was a report, the Kerner report, that validates this, the police started a riot, okay? These folks, I mean, they were pranksters. The Yippies were always pranksters and activists. You have that in every group. SDS were very serious, you know, while they weren't for the establishment, they weren't adverse to becoming the establishment, kind of thing. And the countercultural folks who just wanted to have everybody just calm down and get along and get on with it. There was a riot, there was a lot of violence.
Mm-hmm.
And Mayor Daley from the podium, and the first Mayor Daley, Mayor Richard J. Daley, was shouting about how, you know, there are people outside, you know, it's like, you know, don't let them in here and try to keep them away from the convention center. Now, it's like create this space in front of it where there couldn't be any protesters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what freedom of speech and assembly is about.
No.
And one of the things that came out of that, and you might have experienced this when you were in college, is every college has a free speech area now. You can't just go willy-nilly on the campus and have a demonstration. If you're going to have a demonstration, it has to be in this sector.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you're going to come to the national convention in Florida and you're protesting against the Republican nominee, you will be asked to be 3 miles away. You will not be allowed anywhere near the place. And that isn't what that First Amendment's about.
Yeah.
It occurred. So you had that in Chicago in 68.
Mm-hmm.
Kerner, who had been the governor of Illinois and had been tasked with this report, and it was a police riot. This is the 50th anniversary of the Kent State massacre. And mm-hmm. You see what's going on in Portland?
Yeah.
That's an echo. And yeah. it's more nightmarish because there's more militarization. A lot of this response is to this word defunding
mm-hmm.
the police department. That's not what it is. It's reallocating some resources that go into buying military equipment and training people how to hate. To people who want to help and have a more integrated community in terms of you know who's being protected and served.
Yeah.
But that's, I was thinking about that today, and it's that this is Americanism right now.
Yeah.
This is the ideology. This is white supremacy at its worst. But this is an ism. This is like a minority group, and I'm not talking about people of color. I'm talking about white people.
Mm-hmm.
White people are in the minority, and there's a lot of people in that group that are frightened of losing authority.
Yeah.
And a lot of them will, but there are a lot of people who won't.
Yeah.
You know, it's the extremists got to go. I mean, you know, visions of an America for, you know, Americanism based on race is not America at all.
No.
It's not the promise.
Mm-mm.
And we are not exceptional at the moment.
No, no. I've never felt more ashamed to be an American than I do right now. And I've honestly never felt that way before, like never at all.
No, right. And it's true in all isms. There's a myth.
Yeah.
There's the myth of the Golden Age. There's, I mean, one of the biggest revolutions in American history occurred in 1968 when people started looking at how we taught American history. And we always taught it top down. Here are the great men. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, well, here are some great women. But again, they're all white. And when you go from the grassroots up, you begin getting more diversity. There's nothing more shameful than the fact that the women's suffrage movement felt they could not support African women's suffrage because it meant nobody would get suffrage. Mm-hmm. You know, that became a segregated movement. That, yeah. See, that was a point where women are very powerful, and when they're together like that, they can really make a difference. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's so much inequality. We're so aware of it because of what we all embrace. Yeah. We want to live in at least an equitable society. I don't know if you can get rid of the hate, but the majority of us are ready for something different.
Yeah.
And so it might even be a new ism for a new world. Who knows?
That's what I'm wondering about. Like, you know, all of these isms start with an idea and the idea runs its course. And is this time to somehow for something new to be created that takes the best of each, you know, maybe, who knows, maybe I'll write a political theory.
well, your guess is as good as mine. I will tell you mm-hmm. that whatever happened in November, mm-hmm. it's still my heart, if it is Biden, and I say if because I don't want people to get complacent.
Yeah.
Everyone's got to go out and vote. And if you know someone who's going, well, I don't know, get them to the polling place. Mm-hmm. You have to pick them up and carry them. Get them there. He would be a transition because what's really necessary is a younger group of people to run the country. And this one has been very tough. You know, and I have been identified as a boomer, although I don't identify as a boomer. But that particular age group, you know, the people born between 1940, 1950, the time's up.
Yeah.
And yes, we need the wisdom of our elders. I think that's important. But it's time for a younger set mm-hmm. to come in with better ideas, at least a sense of a moral equanimity that embraces compassion.
Yeah.
And not the bottom line. It can be done. I've seen it done. You know, it can be a very humanitarian economic system. There's no reason for people to go without food, go without clothing, live on the streets. What is that? We're rich.
Yeah.
We're rich. And all it means is now here, this is where the communism comes in. Uh-huh. It's about redistributing the wealth.
Yeah.
Well, when we're very wealthy people hear that, they get crazy.
Yeah.
About it, because what do you mean you're coming and you're gonna? No, we're not gonna take your money, we're gonna ask you to pay in a little more because you're benefiting so much. Mm. What's wrong with that? I mean, that's what people ought to do. I mean, I don't understand why more of these billionaires don't step up and create better educational institutions on the private side, opening their doors. They've got the money to do it.
Yeah.
You know, you're worth $20 billion, so what? Now you're worth $18.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. So it's a mindset. And mm-hmm. but the redistribution of wealth makes people crazy. And the other thing is the people who speak to it are utilizing a very old model.
Yeah.
So even Bernie Sanders, who I love, and free education. Well, you do have to have resources to support that.
Yeah.
Where's that coming from? And that's where it can get dictatorial. I'm going to take this from you. You know, I'm going to be 70, and I'm looking at people who are 50, people in their 40s. Your generation is up and coming and making a huge difference. usually the shift occurs about the time the group gets, you're in your 40s.
Yeah.
It's in the late 30s, early 40s. I don't think we had that. You got Barack Obama, and then we went back to
right.
And so I, it is, you know, okay, boomer. I can really let go, let go. Time to go.
Yeah, it's time for something different. But even speaking along those lines, with something different, why is it that every side sees the other as like, oh, you're a fascist, like you're going to be a dictator? Is it because of that control of power? Is that why people jump to these conclusions? Other speakers, moderators, etc.
I'll explain this after I say it. Whoever you're looking at, you're looking at yourself. Mm-hmm. So the right accuses the left of certain actions that the right is doing and mm-hmm. doesn't see that they're doing it because they're projecting it out. And the left does the same thing. Actually, that really speaks to no kind of inner reflection on anyone's part. Mm-hmm. Parties are only as good as the people who make them up, okay? And if if it's your fault, what I'm doing is I'm just laying it on you. It's not seeing that I do the same thing. It's, again, that truth and reconciliation deal. There are traps all over the place here. So there's no real reflection going on. They just know my idea is better than your idea. Plus, since the Enlightenment, we've lived in a very binary world. More so, you go back to the ancient Hebrew Bible, good and evil, that's binary. You're either absolutely good, you're absolutely evil, there's nothing in between. This is concrete reality. If you approach reality as something that is as hard as concrete, nothing changes.
Yeah.
And you've got, and that's where the kind of middle thing is all about, is yielding to see what's going on. You do what you can do. You don't expect applause for it if you help change it. You listen to every voice that you can, mm-hmm. Nobody's voice is the most important voice in the room. Everybody's voice is the most important in the room. We have to work so hard as individuals to get ourselves into a collective that actually has those principles, kind of a new ethic for human society. Mm-hmm. And you have brief moments here and there, but in the United States, it's a power grab. We're living at a time that is not unlike the 1930s in terms of things erupting radically and suddenly and surprisingly. We have a political crisis, a constitutional crisis, we have a leadership crisis, we have an economic crisis, we have a health crisis, we have a humanitarian crisis. This is the weakness of Americanism. Mm-hmm. We speak about multiculturalism, we speak about diversity. Now, that's more on my generation than yours, because by the time you got into school, this ideology of multiculturalism began being put in place. Education's very powerful. It takes, a generation to really get it going. But once it gets going and gets passed through, an idea is a very powerful thing. And I've watched this when I was an educator, that even at the privileged school I taught at, except for a very few, there are always a few over, quarantining themselves against diversity. But for the most part, I see it, and I'm amazed that when I look and see the students I taught and where life has taken them, and, if they're getting married, who they're marrying. And it's really delightful, because there doesn't seem to be this, self-consciousness of, oh, well, you're Latino? Oh, and I'm not? So what? you know, and or you come from India, or you, it's beautiful. And that's what an education can do. I mean, it's one of the things that died in the 60s, and they're trying to bring back, is civic education. And that was where you brought the ideas of the Democratic Republic into the schools in a very practical way.
Yeah.
You know, you could, and it was part of the curriculum. It, but after 1968, 1970, it began to disappear because you don't, and you've heard me say this before, but, you know, if you teach people that the Constitution is substantive, the Bill of Rights is substantive, the Declaration of Independence is substantive, and that you can petition your government to change its course, that's powerful. That's putting the authority in we the people. So a little more socialism wouldn't be a bad idea, you know, to pay a fair wage, to be there in a crisis. You know, it's capitalism's very selfish.
Yeah.
It's very, very selfish. It's all mine. And okay, well, gee, I need you. I need you to work for 12 to 18 hours just so I can have more.
Yeah.
That's selfish. You know, I know we're supposed to be a Christian nation, but I don't see anyone practicing the precepts.
No.
You know, and while that isn't my background, I understand it, and I don't see that. It, you know, no religion has a monopoly on compassion. No religion has a monopoly on making things better for those that are underserved.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, religion is one of the biggest isms, too.
We are doing an interesting religious themed episode later in the season, so we'll keep you posted on that. But yeah, it's definitely all intertwined, and that, you know, it's not. I feel like people always confine themselves into the one thing, whereas there's other options. Like, there's more awareness. Open your mind to what else.
Part of it is that people are very afraid, but there's no getting around that. You know, we each have to face that in ourselves. They just want everything to be okay. And if trading a little bit of their liberty out for security, they'll do that. But they really have to be careful when all of us do what we do that.
Yeah.
Because you're never going to get it back.
No.
You know, Ben Franklin said this about democratic capitalism. He said, you know, we have a democratic republic. Now let's hope we keep it. Because it's a very fragile thing, and we can see how fragile it is.
Yeah.
When you don't have the right leader in place and something catastrophic happens, you feel powerless to stop it, but we're not powerless. Just as fascism and communism and you know, unbridled capitalism looks like they have a majority of people that are rah-rah. There are always people pushing from behind. And we have such a great opportunity now to create something. You're right, a little bit from here, a little bit from there. I still think a democratic republic is great.
Yeah.
And I still think our Constitution is a miraculous document, even though it's based on a lot of misconceptions like this was an empty space. You know, and because we're European, we're awesome, and everybody else sucks. You know, there's that racist mentality that runs through the whole thing, but that we can change.
Mm-hmm.
I know we have the power to change that. And I hate to see us resort to violence.
Yeah, me too.
We've never done that in this country. Mm-hmm. We've never, you know, an election happens, nobody got out and, you know, try to kill somebody because the outcome wasn't what we wanted. We don't do that.
Yeah.
But apparently we're beginning to do that. And it's
I hope for all of our safety that, you know, that change of power, that peaceful transition can and will remain, because that's what gives me hope, is that you know, all of the other people working on Capitol Hill, or, you know, everyone who's a part of that would step up and say, no, like, that's not what this country is built on. So that's what, when I start to get, my heart starts to race, I tell myself, give people a chance. Dr. Day, this has been amazing. I'm so glad to have you on the show. Do you have anything else you want our audience to know or to leave with them?
Yeah, get out, vote. Make sure you take an extra person with you when you vote. It is so important. Mm-hmm. Even if you were a Bernie Sanders person, you still can be a Bernie Sanders person. Biden is the best bet. Our goal is to just get us calmed down enough to prepare for your advent on the stage. Yeah. And we're all looking forward to the changes that your generation is going to bring for us. I'm looking forward to it.
And I know we will. I have so much faith in us.
Yes.
Today's show. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can email us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at @sitstill_lookopinionated and on Twitter at @sitstillpodcast. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. This podcast was produced by Michael Dritto and written by myself, Claire Malky, and Michael Dritto. Theme music by Terrence Jackson. Transition music by Christina Walter. Research by Ross Black. And of course, I'm your host, Claire Malky. See you next week. Bye.